forever. Dog.
Comic books, comic time. Writers and artists are on the line. They make a splash as a comic's read and take us on a trip behind the spread. Watch out for comic book commentary. Spinning a winning inside fix, how they got a hot idea. Narrative, character, visual tricks, and bam, onomatopoeia. Uh-huh. It's comic book commentary.
Hi everyone, I'm Teenie Howard, the author of Euthanauts, and today we're going to be doing comic book commentary for issue number one. The reason we're doing this now is because the trade paperback, which is the collected book of the first five issues of the series, is out today in comic book stores and bookstores. So I wanted to have a chance to revisit issue one with people that read the book when it first came out and might be going back to reread it if they liked it enough to pick up the trade. And also people who might be coming to the book for the first time today, or maybe fans of my other work who are checking this out and this might be their first exposure to Euthanauts. I recommend having a copy of the book in front of you in some capacity, or at least maybe having read it if you feel like you can envision it in your head or what have you. But yeah, we're going to go through the first issue kind of page by page, panel by panel, and talk a little about it. So I'm going to talk to you guys as though you're holding the trade paperback, because that's what I'm holding in my hands right now. And that's the way a lot of you will be reading the book. But if you're reading a floppy or a digital copy, you can still follow along. You just might miss a few things. So we'll start right at the cover. First things first, our beautiful logo by the incredible Philip Bond, who is a wonderful artist, who I know from one of my favorite books, Kill Your Boyfriend, which was a book he did with Grant Morrison. He's the designer for Black Crown. He does all of the incredible logos you see on their books, Black Crown being the imprint that Euthanauts is published under as a part of IDW. But yeah, all of the beautiful book, all the things you see on their books, from the Black Crown logo to this Euthanauts logo to the really cool, like, the Joy Division motif, the beautiful design of these trades. They look great. These are books that you want to hold in your hand, and that look cool. You know, they feel cool to hold and to read. And a lot of that is due to Philip Bond's work, and he doesn't get enough credit on this, but designers in general don't get enough credit, I think. So I wanted to give him some credit. We're also going to talk a lot about my co-collaborator, my co-creator and the artist on the book, without whom it would not be real, Nick Robles, who is an incredible, phenomenal, just dynamo of an artist who is kind of really on a lot of people's radar right now and exciting a lot of people, rightly so, with just really incredible work he's doing. I'm really excited to go through his work and talk about it with you guys, about, you know, just what it was like seeing some of this come to life for the first time, because Nick is just a dream to work with in every possible way. He also colored this first issue that we're going to talk about, but I would be remiss if I didn't mention our amazing colorist on issues 2 through 5, Eva Dela Cruz, who came on and helped us out by coloring the rest of the series. And she's great. I'd worked with her before on a story I did for Black Crown called Ghost Walk With Me, that was about these two girls, and she colored it in this really cool purple color scheme, and it was fantastic. I really liked working with her, so I was really happy for her to do the rest of the series. But the issue that we'll be looking at today, Nick drew, inked, colored it. He did the whole thing. It was his baby, and it was really special because it really set the tone. It set our characters' color schemes. Our characters have just I love the palette of this book so much. And Nick coloring that first issue and taking on that extra work was really fundamental in doing that for us. And then Eva coming on to fill that and also add in her own amazing color sense. It was just really cool. And then I have to also mention Aditi Abitakar, who is my favorite letterer, and I worked with him on all of my creator-owned projects so far. He's phenomenal. I'm so glad that he is, that people are taking notice of what an incredible letter he is. He's definitely a letterer who brings, you know, he's a storyteller. You know, he's not just putting up, you know, balloons on the page. He's a storyteller in his own right, and he's fantastic. And he lettered this issue for us, which I'm very glad about. So this beautiful cover drawn by Nick Robles, it was one of the first images, I think, that this image got put together really early on in the Euthanauts process, but I remember it took us a while to land on it. I think this was like something like Nick's like seventh sketch that he had sent us, and we were like, that's it. Everything about it. I have this cover on my banner and it stops people in their tracks. You know, it is metaphorical without being cliche. It's incredibly visually arresting. The colors are beautiful. There's so many questions, and that the reason that we were able to make an image like that for our issue one cover was because we spent so much time together, you know, working on the story and the characters and designing them and loving them. And you know, when Nick drew this in the moths, and even the single moth on the outside, like with that was, this whole process was super, it was all collaborative. It was just all falling in love with Talia and getting to know her. And this image was really, when it came together very strongly for all of us. When I say all of us, I not only mean me and Nick, I mean our incredible editor, Shelley Bond, who is the editrix supreme of Black Crown and a dear friend and mentor to me, and someone who has taught me more about comics than I thought possible, and someone whose influence on my work is like, it's an everyday thing. I mean, every day when I'm working, no matter what I'm working for, or who I'm working for, or what I'm working on, I working with Shelley just fundamentally changed who I am as a writer, how I work, in a way that feels entirely me. She's really, really good at making the work that comes out of me, making me turn it into the best work it can be. She doesn't let me get lazy. She's like a Russian gymnastics coach. She pushes me because she hears me talk about something and here's how I explain it and here's how passionate I am about it. And she hears that passion and she just wants me to translate it into what is actually coming out on the page, which is like the hardest part of being a writer, I think. No one has ever told you that. The hardest part of being a writer, in my opinion, is making people feel when they read your words the way you feel when you think about what it is you're trying to write. Getting that right feels like playing, kind of feels like playing a game of telephone, like between your ideas, like the part of my brain that daydreams and the part of my brain that makes words have to communicate, and the part of my brain that makes words has to communicate with the part of my, the word on the page, thing on the page that I've typed. And then that has to be read by someone else who has to take it in and then also have feelings about it. So it's like a several step process to write a thing down and effectively. Shelley's really good. sorry, blew up the mic there. Shelley's really good at helping me do that. So let's open the book, right? 8 minutes in. If you're reading the trade, inside the front cover, there's some really lovely words that some really lovely people have said about the book and this this lovely two-page credit spread and Scott Snyder's incredible essay that he did for us after tweeting some very nice things about the book. We reached out to him and asked him if he wouldn't mind writing an introduction for us, and I was so pleased that he said yes, because I'm a huge fan of the essays that he used to write in his book, Witches. I think he's an incredible horror writer. And he wrote something, you know, in that vein about fear and dying as our intro for our book. And that was really, really special to me. And there's some incredible Nick art there of Mercy, who you'll get to know, or you might already know if you've read the series, but if you haven't, you'll get to know her. I love her design so much. A lot of it, I there were, you know, certain aspects that I knew when I, you know, told Nick about her. I had kind of a vision of, you know, various things, oxygen masks and lilies, and Nick had the kind of brilliant stroke of genius to make her cloak in kind of a circle, like a circular garment in the shape of a lily. And it has the brilliant effect of when she's standing, it looks like a hospital gown. And when she's floating through space, as she often is, it looks like a lily. Because Nick Robles is a genius. This is mostly just going to be me talking about him. And if you open to the next page, that Talia image again with a quote, it was really fun to go through and select quotes. I think Shelley mostly did that for each chapter break in the trade, but this one, we're tied together across the living and the dead, you and me, kind of became like a mantra for the series. So that was neat. Page one, I remember, we start here and I always knew I wanted us to open on Indigo and his mother. It was really important to me that one of the first images in the series that we see in this series about death, that it was something loving, but also jarring and confronting to the reader. So we see a lot in comics of bodies, especially women's bodies, mutilated, maimed, dead, corpsey, whatever. And often those are done to either be terrifying or at times like lurid. And I kind of had this thing of wanting to display a woman's body with a dead woman's body with love, a body that had lived a life and you know, been on this planet and lived and loved and then died. It was important to me to show someone just like loving a dead body for who it had been. I don't know. It felt subversive to me in a weird way. Like, I try not to be super Pollyanna, but sometimes I feel like there's something very subversive about just love. Just being open and loving to things that are scary or things that are easy to exploit. To choosing to love them instead, I think, is kind of subversive and neat. So I sound really pretentious. I'm not trying to. But this is... That was my thought, you know? That I wanted to just show, I wanted to introduce this character Indigo as someone who was loving, you know, his mother in death. And to that, I'll also say before we get farther into it, this book would not exist without the people in that are doing great work in what's kind of called the death positive community, which is like a community of really great thinkers, writers, YouTubers, funeral home directors, activists, people of all stripes who are working to help change and normalize our conversations about death and dying. I'm someone who has long grown up with like a kind of lurid fascination / abject horror of the concept of death. I've never really thought that I'm going to go anywhere when I die. I've always kind of known that there's just like blackness there. And that shaped me a lot. And this book was kind of me about how I stopped worrying and learned to love it. And learned to understand the power of death is that it should cause us to think every day about what we do with our lives and to love and honor it and face it bravely and to honor those who have died, and those that loved them, those who are grieving a death, those who are present for a death, the dying themselves, you know, who are still human and not to be forgotten just because they're on their way out. Anyway, amazing, amazing people. One of them I would really love to shout out because she's on YouTube. She has a channel called Ask a Mortician. Her name is Caitlin Doughty. She's also a brilliant writer. I read her books multiple times and watched hours of her YouTube channel. And now I'm a regular watcher of her YouTube channel. Talks very frankly and very wisely about death and dying, and is also a professional in the funeral industry herself. So I found her work and her research to be very informative as parts of this book take place at a funeral home. And our main character, Talia, works in the funeral industry. So back to Indigo and his mother, who has died. We flip open to that page 2-3 spread that was one of those early moments when I got art from Nick and I knew that, you know, oh, I was in love. I was in deep with this book, that this book and I are really, I'm a goner, you know, was this page. And that line, "We do not mourn like most," that's a Nick Robles line. There are so many moments where he, you know, did some of the work that I often do, usually do, which is great. Because writers, we kind of naturally assume that we can occasionally do the artist's work, and we don't ever think that it goes the other way. Like, we'll all occasionally be like, "Hey, let me just draw you a dumb sketch of what I imagine this layout looking like," or "I designed this outfit of these three dresses I saw in a magazine. Draw them together like this." You know, it's like you're doing kind of the visual lifting sometimes. Hopefully not all the time, but sometimes as a writer, you know, it's important to say, "Hey, it needs to look like this," or "It needs to look like that," because I've envisioned it that way. What's cool is that Nick is an artist who's not afraid to do the same back, to say, "Hey, we're working on this together. I think like issue 3, he completely moved scenes around. Was just like, I drew the issue. I printed out my layouts and I realized that it read better if we moved some scenes. And so we did. And there were moments where he would just say, "Hey, you know, I had this line, I had this moment. I wanted to call this thing, that thing. What about this phrase? What about this line of dialogue?" And I think I always say yes. It's not really, it doesn't feel like my permission to give. It's our book. If it's speaking to him too, you know? So when he's like, "Hey, Indigo, I think Indigo should say this," like what I'm actually hearing is like, "Indigo said this to me, we should put it in the book." So we do. In this beautiful scene of Indigo lighting his mother's funeral pyre. And I will have you know, I've done some research and I don't know what state they're in that this sort of funeral pyre is legal. Though you do have more rights than you think to the bodies of loved ones after they pass. And I encourage you to look into those laws and regulations where you are, because you you may indeed have the right to wash and dress and care for your loved ones after they've died, if you so choose, as Indigo does. However, lighting a giant Viking pyre gets into zoning laws, I think, in some places. Another thing I love about this spread is how beautifully, I don't know about you guys, I'm a bit of a hippy-dippy flake. I've been to a couple big witch parties in my time, and I'll tell you that this is what they look like. You know, the people here are not homogenous. They're not one shape. They're not one color. They're not one convention of beauty. You can see that these are people who are feeling, they all feel beautiful in their own way. They're all there to party and feel good and have a good time and to celebrate this life. And for them, that all means something different. And you can tell that it is meaning for all of them. Because as we said on the last page, Nick Robles is a genius. We're going to say that every page, I think. So on the next spread here, we finally check in with Talia, that the mysterious girl from the cover. And we check in with her right away. It was almost impossible for me to not. I sometimes resist. Some characters don't have internal monologue to me, and some do. And Talia really did. And it's almost necessary because she has that habit that a lot of very anxious people do, which is like a lot of things sound good in her head, and then like she doesn't say a lot of them out loud. So like I felt almost like in a way this was like for her internal monologue, it was almost like having like access to her private Twitter. Like if you followed her private Twitter, this is what you would hear, is all of her like freaking out about what's going on and also secretly thinking about how she doesn't like her friends very much. Her nasty friends were like just kind of my attempt at writing people that were like clever but unlikable. Who's then talking about how he's very likable. I think like I thought about these people more at one time than I do now, and then I think that's correct also. Like these are the people that like are just her friends because they're around, but when she gets purpose and learns to, I think that a sense of purpose, you know, causes you to kind of prioritize your own life and your own time. So like if you have people that you're hanging out with because you just kind of feel obligated to hang out with them, but then something in your life happens where you remember like, oh, this is what it feels like to feel good or to feel devoted to something. You kind of reevaluate those relationships of obligation and you're like, nah, I don't, you know, if I could spend an hour at the lab studying this death stuff that gives me purpose, why would I spend an hour having drinks with you while you talk about yourself? So these characters kind of faded out of her life and into the background. And I like realized that that was correct. And that there wasn't like a big divorce, you know, I don't think she's ever, she probably still texts them on their birthdays or whatever, but she stops hanging out with them, I think. So this encounter, here on the next page where Talia is eating with some friends and sees a woman who's very clearly dying across a restaurant. That happened to me. Not that that's that shocking. The dying go out to eat as well. But it's always, there's something a little jarring about just seeing someone who you know is on their way out. And it shouldn't be, like it shouldn't be, you know, death is a part of life. But that experience years ago kind of stuck with me. And when something sticks with me like that, I usually know, I don't know if you believe that anything's ever trying to tell any of us anything, but I felt like there was something to that sticking with me. And I think that it, in a lot of ways, was the seed of my own personal like death positivity journey, was seeing that woman and being like, that I'm freaked out by her, but I shouldn't be. Like, she's dying. Like, if she'd been recently born, I wouldn't be freaked out. I'd be like, oh, it's a baby. But she's recently dying, or she's going to die soon, and I'm, like, freaking out about it. And I'm like, but I shouldn't. Like, she's just out having dinner with her family, right? Like, so brave of me to, like, let her do that. But really, like, it sparked for me a conversation with myself. Like I definitely didn't go and like talk to this woman in a bathroom. I just saw her and went back about my day, but seeing her shook something in me that became a conversation with myself about death and life. And from that conversation came a really deep passion that became a very big part of my life and the core of this book in a lot of ways. So we meet her though. We'll meet her. I want to spend another minute on this page just because it has one of my favorite panels in the whole series with Talia with her glasses and her little snake bite piercings, wondering what do you even order to eat, knowing you might not live long enough to digest it. I remember writing that line and it freaked me out in a good way. Like I started thinking about like my dinner that night, you know, and it got me in my feelings. And Nick just drew this panel with Mercy reflected in such a way that it felt as dreadful. It felt as dreadful to look at it as it did to write it. and I knew it was good. Oh, and then this is the page where Talia's friends make fun of her for being goth when she was a teenager. And that's like another thing that I love is like they kind of make fun of her for being goth and or for formerly being goth. And she's like not really goth here. She's just kind of like in a black and white outfit. And then like as she starts like hanging out with the gother kids, like the Euthanauts, she kind of is her dress gets like a little either she's in like her sweats and stuff. But like when she's in a dress and stuff, she wears like, you know, black and her funeral dress and stuff. So it's like she kind of goes back to being a little more goth when she doesn't hang out with jerks who make fun of her. So yeah, flipping the page, this beautiful, beautiful page of Talia walking into the bathroom with the balloon, thinking about the balloon, going to the women's room is just really great. That like looming darkness of a restaurant hallway walking to the bathroom is such a like weird solitary thing. I talk a lot in this book about Talia and how she loves disassociating. Cause I do too. And like, that's a big thing for people with social anxiety. You know, if you're in a group and it's draining you and it's feeling really hard, getting up and going to the bathroom for a minute or something. And I feel like a lot of people can identify with that moment that feels like you need a whole page just to breathe and walk to the bathroom. Talia needed that there. And I really love that we were able to do that. And I love that panel of her staring herself in the face, prying her eyeball open. That's another like quintessential Talia panel to me. So on this page, she thinks that maybe she's made it up, or maybe she's seen this dying woman and that she's the Grim Reaper and that she's going to die. And this woman has come to collect her. And then she starts having this morbid thought, well, maybe she's going to die here and I'll see her, which is another thing. I saw a lady, this is very upsetting. I saw a woman die at a restaurant once. Right. How do we move on from that? I did though. And it really freaked me out in a big way. Again, one of those things that when I thought about it, I have this thing where like, there are certain thoughts that when I have them, it feels like I'm holding like a lighter to my skin. You know, it's just, it feels like it's too much, like trying to look at it is too bright or it's too hot to touch. And sometimes when I get there, I'm like, that's what I got to write about. That's the thing that has to be in the book. The thing that makes me feel like that. Right. So, seeing a woman die before my eyes in a restaurant, I mean, and it wasn't violent. It was just unfortunate. And I still thinking about that freaks me out. So I wanted to put it in the book in a really sinister way. Like Talia's hoping that will happen because she thinks she wants to see it, even though me as the author, I know she doesn't want to see it because I've seen it. Does that make sense? Anyway, in comes Mercy. I love Mercy. I'm very glad you get to meet Mercy. I'm very glad she sticks around in the series. She's another thing I wanted to put in the comic, which was like or in comics that I didn't see a lot of, which is like a dying person. A very visibly sick person, because people who are visibly sick and dying are still people, you know? But she's, you know, a character. She's not there to be, you know, for people to fight over her. I mean, sure, people have to rescue her, but not because of her physical illness, but more because of her tragic ambition. And there's this conversation I love where Talia kind of instantly realizes how rude she's being and is trying to cover for it by being really bubbly, which is like, I think a thing that millennials do, being one, where we like, we'll gawk at something or like, you know, share a video or retweet something. And then someone's like, hey, you're kind of in my space. And we're like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. Let me tell you about myself. And she kind of starts by doing that. And she also is kind of doing this like thing where she's like, oh, this dying woman is going to like be my therapy. Poor Talia. She wises up. And Mercy has this line that I love, which is very Mercy, which is like, are you okay? No, obviously, but I'm fine with it. Like, I'm not okay. I'm dying, but I've accepted it. And she said something Shelley, I remember, loved pointing this out, which is that Mercy refers to having dinner with her family before she dies as having dinner plans with some people. And yeah, Mercy Wolf is one of those names that just like, when I say it out loud, it almost sounds like, oh, come on, Mercy Wolf. But like, that was her name. Like, it just, it came out of her, it came out of my head. And I was like, that's her name. It had been other things and they didn't seem right. And Wolf really did. I think, did Nick suggest that her last name be Wolf? I don't know. And it becomes really important later on that her name is Wolf, but that wasn't intentional. So I guess it worked. And her and Mercy take hands and Mercy tells her all about death and they kind of bond because Talia and Mercy both clearly have, for different reasons, obsessions with death. And so Mercy offers to share her joint with her, to smoke her medicine. And Talia reaches her hand in her purse and that's when everything gets real crazy. This two-page spread here where Nick like breaks the book open just kills me. The fact that if you hold the book a certain way, it's Talia laying on the floor and Mercy on the wall and the space breaking out under them and the tiles. I mean, it's just, there's a lot of this book that I think it was just me wanting to just get out of Nick's way and let him work. Because I know that he just so intrinsically got what we were trying to do and that I just, you know, got to let him have his part in it. Also, I think the thing of her getting cracked over the head with the oxygen tank, I feel like was a Shelley Bondism. I think originally I had Mercy putting the mask on Talia's face. And Shelley was like, that's no fun. She'd hit her with it. So she does. And I love that. And Mercy's, you know, unfortunate statement of like, both of us have our future planned. Our future is that we're dead. And then there's this kind of triptych page. I love, well, I guess not really a triptych. It's in more than three parts of Talia, this page of her, you know, sitting at her computer, recovering from a strange night and these, mysterious visions of her in a church, in the helmet, in the graveyard, and none of them really make sense to us now, of why she's so pulled to this. Again, one of the early panels that let me know we were onto something really special is the panel of Talia sitting by the grave, and you can see Mercy through the bottom of it. And then we meet the two characters who were literally just originally in my mind. You know, my villain needs two goons. They became really, really special characters. They're my sidekicky characters, Guillaume and Cersei. I didn't realize that Cersei and Mercy rhymed until way later, but it worked. Especially for issue 5 when we wrote a song. I got to use a lot of really good words on this page because Guillaume is really fun to write. He's like an academic, and so I wanted to write just the goofiness in of him. He's just a vocab guy. He just likes $10 words, and he's a kind of poetic. So he refers to the stretcher as a catafalque, and Cersei's kind of goth, so she gets poetic with him. And we also use the word psychopomps. And we also drop the word euthanauts inside the book, which is that, you know, a psychopomp is a spirit guide from one life to the next, or a taker of spirits from one life to the next. Or, you know, he says, we're not that, we're euthanauts, which, you know, is meant to imply we kind of go ourselves. And they go to the hospital to get Talia, ostensibly because Mercy has said, you know, go get the girl I cracked over her head from this hospital. And Talia, meanwhile, is back at home recovering and having strange visions. But they get to the hospital, and not only is the girl not there, but there's a note there and a little symbol. But they need the girl because she's a tether. And the girl's Talia. Okay, you guys are reading the book. You get it. These beautiful, beautiful Talia's apartment is a space that, like, we only spend a little bit of time in, but I love it a lot. I think we go back to it in later issues just because I really loved the design Nick did, the like the butterfly and moth thing, the fact that there's like the spire tower, her little toys and Cheshire cats and Grim Reapers and her goth chair. There's just so many details that I love. But she goes up here and Mercy appears to her. And they have this very expository and cerebral conversation in which Talia says, I have a concussion and you're appearing to me and you hit me and this is all very confusing. And Mercy's just such a mouthful. I wish I could say that writing like that was like difficult or like sluggish. I really like writing Mercy. Lines like, if by ghost you mean an energetic force bound by dwindling egoic connections to a person, place, or object, there's no proof this exists. Which is a take. But I like to think she dumbs it down enough. And Talia's also good at trying to pin her down and get her to give answers. Anyway, and Mercy makes clear that she wasn't dead when she hit Talia, but she is now. She has died with a, which she planned with a mouthful of Seek and All Chase the Vodka. And Talia gets upset because Mercy explains you need to have an ego to do the work that she's been chosen for. And Talia, like a lot of people, bristles at that. Because she takes ego to be a bad thing, and Mercy kind of explains that it's a functional thing. You know, consciousness is exhausting here on this another incredible spread here. If you can hold together, if you can die on your own terms, you can do something else. You can use your will to build a vessel and go into the next life. That's when Talia enters the death space for the first time, and the book takes a turn. I don't know. I feel like it's so hard to talk about this stuff. I feel like I could and then I couldn't. So this spread was really, really hard. I have a real big love for like painterly big two-page spreads of characters moving through a space. I think they read really beautifully. Even though they're a bit challenging, I think sometimes that they provide a better flow than just like a standard panel spread. I wanted them to have this motion that feels like a dance. I love when you follow their figures across the page. You can almost hear the swelling violins as Mercy kind of spins her around and as she makes her suit out of the ether and then spins her off. And she calls her a regular Major Tom, which is one of about 18 Bowie references in this book. Sometimes Talia's assessments of things are me trying to explain a feeling to myself. So when I say that it felt like a dream about a spacewalk played in reverse, that's me trying to accurately explain to myself the feeling of what I think that would feel like. And then sometimes I make myself laugh with those. So I put them in the book. This is kind of this little test of her ego and her will. You know, she can't breathe, so she has to form a helmet. She has the ego and the will to form a helmet, so she forms a suit and she can breathe and she can live, so she gets to live. It's kind of like throwing a baby in the water to see if it swims. And they do, and she does. But she tells her, you know, that, you know, you've got to have the will and you've got to be a tether, and that most people who die don't go into this beautiful afterlife. Most of them just fade away. They don't have the will and the ego to form a suit and to keep themselves from being just coldly picked apart by the nothingness of the void of the afterlife and the death space. And on the last page, we see Talia fading away from Mercy in the death space, knowing that now Mercy has her and they are tied together. She's been chosen. She doesn't quite know why yet. And we see a coffin, and the mysterious boy from page one in front of yet another funeral pyre, pulling something out of his adorable coat that Nick drew him in. And inside the coffin is Talia, and she's awake. And that is Euthanauts, issue one, by myself and Nick Robles. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you enjoyed going over it with me and listening to me talk about the book. I hope I answered a lot of your questions. There's a lot. I put a lot in this book that's very dense, and it's kind of a trippy read. And I'm sure that after reading the rest of the book, you guys, if you're reading this one again in trade, you might have questions for me. Reach out to me. Find me. I'm on Twitter at Teeny Howard. The at sign just in front of the name like it is on the book. With no space. T-I-N-I Howard. And shoot me a tweet if you listen to this. And if there are any questions about the first issue that I didn't answer for you, hit me up. I always love to talk comics with people that are reading my work. I hope if you have the trade paperback that you enjoy reading the rest of it with some of my commentary in mind and a little bit of knowledge of how the sausage was made in mind. If that was just you checking out issue one, I hope you were intrigued enough to pick up the trade paperback wherever comics are sold. And please leave us a review if you can on Goodreads or Amazon or tell your friends, buy it as a gift, tell your book club, tell your librarian. If you like the book, please, you know, we as comic creators, these passion projects, when they find an audience, it can be really special for us. And I'm very grateful for you guys, not only reading the book, but coming to listen to me talk this afternoon and tell you a little more about something very special to me. And I hope you enjoyed it. And I hope it freaked you out a little and maybe changed your relationship with death and dying, or at least sparked your interest. And I encourage you all to always be conscious of your relationship with those things and to process them in a way that is safe and healthy and positive for you. And as always, thank you for being readers, and thanks for being friends.
Forever Dog.
This has been a Forever Dog production. Executive produced by Brett Boehm, Joe Cilio, and Alex Ramsey. For more original podcasts, please visit foreverdogpodcasts.com and subscribe to our shows on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Keep up with the latest Forever Dog news by following us on Twitter and Instagram @ForeverDogTeam and liking our page on Facebook.